Welcome to Cultimatum, the podcast uncovering the dark realities of cults and human trafficking. I'm your host, Anonymous Andrew, and each week we dive deep into the manipulation, control, and courageous escapes that define these worlds.
And I'm Melody, Andrew's co-host. Having experienced the depth of a cult firsthand, specifically the House of Yahweh, I am here as an advocate for fellow survivors.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests are their own and do not reflect the official policy or position of Cultimatum or its affiliates. The content discussed on this podcast are based on personal experiences and should not be construed as factual or legal advice. Neither the host nor the guest are liable for any statements made during the episodes. Listeners are encouraged to conduct their own research and seek professional advice where appropriate.
And before we dive into today's episode, we want to issue a trigger warning. Some episodes may cover explicit and potentially disturbing subjects such as sexual abuse, rape, human trafficking, suicide, and other sensitive subjects. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Cultimatum Podcast, a culture of cults and human trafficking. My name is Anonymous Andrew, and tonight my co-host Melody joins me, and we have a very special episode tonight because we have the second part of our subheading, right? Human trafficking. So,
yes.
Melody, take it away.
Yes, we have not had as many human trafficking survivors as we'd like on the show. But today we have the honor of speaking with Caroline Pugh Roberts, a survivor of human trafficking and an inspiring advocate for awareness and change. Caroline's journey is one of resilience and courage and hope, and we're grateful for her willingness to share her story with us. While it's never easy to share these traumatic stories and experiences, her voice is vital to the reality of trafficking and how we can work together to combat it. She is not only a major advocate in Canada for trafficking survivors, but she's also the creator and administrator of a Facebook group titled Human Trafficking Awareness-No Traffic Zone. Caroline, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. Your timing is good because people are becoming more and more aware of trafficking, and especially the fact that it's not just an international issue. It's happening locally, and it's happening to your children, our children.
Yes.
I, myself, I'm a survivor of 8 years of trafficking. Now, when I first started being trafficked, I held a silver medal at the Canadian Nationals in skydiving. I was a skydiving instructor. I had traveled the world extensively. I spoke the better part of 5 languages. And so you have to know, if that could happen to me, imagine how easily it can happen to a 12-year-old who has no life experience. Now, I was married to a South African man, and he went over to Thailand. He was a registered Thai massage therapist to get more education, and the tsunami hit. He disappeared. I was dealing with the Thai authorities, and they were sending me photos of bodies that had been in the water for days trying to identify them, and I couldn't. Within the next 6 months, I lost my mom and my 2 best friends. So I was struggling with undiagnosed clinical depression and something called complicated grief. My friend's husband introduced me to her husband. I mean, to her husband's best friend. It was winter when I met this guy. I never got into a cold car. The snow was always cleared off. And he did something that we see, which is very common, called love bombarding. He showered me with gifts. He told me everything was going to be okay, and it was what I needed to hear at the time. There's actually a term for it. It's called the lover boy / Romeo pimp scenario. And that is what we primarily see in domestic sex trafficking in North America and Europe also, but Europe has gangs, whereas we're not quite there yet. So he said he offered for me to move in with him, and I did. Now, shortly after moving in, his ex-wife arrived with her son at our door at about 3 in the morning, roughly. She couldn't handle him. He didn't really want this child, and I couldn't look at him. He was 7 and say, you know, I didn't want him either. So I said, come. Now, this is where my invisible chains really started, because I wasn't going to leave this child behind, and I didn't have the legal authority to remove him. I allowed this guy, I don't name him because he is associated with organized crime, and it's not safe for me to do that. But I don't know how it works there. I'm in Canada, but if the rent isn't being paid and it goes through the courts, the sheriff arrives at your door. And once the sheriff arrives, it's done. You're out. And unbeknownst to me, this was going on because I let him handle the finances. I was such an emotional mess. And it was at this point he said to me, now it was my turn to take care of the family. And this is a word we hear all the time because family is synonymous with love and unity and belonging. And this is what so many kids want. They want a family. They want to be loved. So it's smart. These traffickers play on Maslow's hierarchy. I don't know if you know Maslow's hierarchy, you know, the safety, stability, and then you go up to eventually to self-actualization, but you never get there with these traffickers. And I was going to be stripping in the bars. Now, you don't get paid to work in a strip bar. You walk in and pay them for the privilege of working. You have to spend a minimum of 4 hours on the floor and do a minimum of 3 stage shows. Now, the first song, when you're up on stage, you're fully clothed. But I should have prefaced this with, you also have to tip the DJ. And if you don't tip the DJ, he can make your life hell. Now, many of these women are walking in. They've had to pay for a babysitter. They've had to pay for a driver. They've had to pay the house fee and tip the DJ. So you can walk in $100 in the hole before you even start. So the second song, when you're up there, a top or a bottom comes off. The third song, you're fully naked. And all the while, you've got, often it's university guys, young guys, think they're being funny, trying to outdo each other, yelling things at you like, my granny's got nicer boobs than you. And you're extremely vulnerable up there when you're naked, but all the while you have to smile because the stage is considered advertising. Okay, so you come off the stage and then you walk from table to table trying to get guys to take you for a dance into the back and what I call sexually assault you. Now, I've seen everything going on in strippers, including fisting, okay? So if somebody tells you that that stuff's not going on in the bars, they're lying to you or they've never been. A song is, what, average 3-4 minutes? And it was like $20 a song before extras. So he would sit on the floor and count how many songs I was back there. So you couldn't hide the money. And if once you're working in a bar, you learn to see who's being run by who and who's running who. I did not drink. I had, so my first sexual assault was when I was 6, okay? I was then raped at 14, raped at 16, and raped at 18. And when that rape happened, I killed him. I had to. It was him or me. I pushed him out a window. We were 8 floors up. So subconsciously, I had already been taught and learnt that my body was for the taking. So it wasn't such of a leap for me to go to that place. But I started drinking because it was the only way I could handle the guys in the back. Because, I mean, they would come with dildos. They would come. I mean, I used to try and joke about it and say the least you could have done was brought something in a package, something new. You know, that's the least you could have done, but they didn't. So you're making your money. And if you don't make it, well, you do. You have to make it. My quota back then, I'm going back 10 years now, it was like $500 a day, okay, which is a fair amount of money. And you stay until you make it. Or you go and you make it somewhere else if you don't make the quota. And I'm not the only one that was there like that. Now, strip bars, when you walk in, ostensibly everyone's having a great time, everybody loves everybody, but it's not like that. We, the women, are in competition with each other. We all have quotas. We are going to get hurt if we don't make that quota. So we are not friends, okay? We're not friends at all. I've seen urine and feces poured on the girl's stuff at the back. I've seen a broken beer bottle taken to a woman's face because she was with another girl's regular. I've seen, these deep heat creams put on G-strings, so when you put them on, it hurts you. It's not what you think and what you see. Although, when the guys come in, I'll tell them that they're the greatest customer I've ever had, and I will laugh, and I'll joke, and I'll tell them they're so handsome, and they smell so good. Meanwhile, it's exactly the opposite, but the thing is, I need that money. So we will tell him whatever he needs to hear to make that money. I know now with hindsight, because I've had education and I've had time out, that these places are where a lot of the men go and get their self-esteem. It's a fix, okay? And they'll go out and they'll be good for a day or two and they have to come back in and get their self-esteem again because we give it to them. We had found another place. I was helping this child, teaching how to read and write. And ironically enough, I had a tad more freedom in that he would start to disappear for longer periods of time because he knew I wouldn't leave that kid. Now, what happens with traffickers is they have what's called a stable. And there's however many women they have in it, girls, women, sometimes three, sometimes four, sometimes more. But they are making on average $350,000 a year off of each one of us. So you do the math. So I tell people, if you think you're coming across a human trafficking scenario, be very careful getting between her and him and $350,000, because it can get dangerous really, really quickly. So I had eventually, we got evicted again. Now, I had been clean 20 years. I was an addict due to my trauma earlier. I had been clean 20 years when I met this guy. And one night, I was lying on the floor because I always had to be within eyesight of him. He woke me up and put a crack pipe in my face and said, if you don't take a hit of this, I will never let you sleep again. I'm an addict. One hit and I'm right back where I started. Okay. For an addict, one hit is too much and one is not never enough. Okay. So now I'm an addict. I'm smoking crack. I'm drinking. I'm stripping. And I have very little of my possessions left. I have been totally isolated from all my friends and my brother, who's all I had. In fact, I couldn't even garden in the daytime. I had to garden at night by flashlight because that's how controlled I was. I would sometimes be allowed to walk to the corner store. Although, like I said, when he started disappearing, I had a tad more freedom, but I had no money. So I would get on my bicycle and ride around town, climbing into open dumpsters, looking for unopened sanitary products and unopened food to feed myself and this child. Meanwhile, you know, I worked it out the other day. Because I was trafficked for 8 years. He made over $1 million off of me. And here I am climbing into dumpsters. I wasn't raised like this. I said to him, I can't do this. It's when my toes got broken. All of them. Because you know what? You don't talk back and you do what you're told. I eventually managed to get his son back to his mother, who was able to take care of him again. But we had been evicted again. And now we're living in motels. Now where I live, the area I live in, there's this strip of really filthy, seedy motels. The one room I was in, the room next to me, there was an eviction after a week. They found 200 used syringes in that room within a week, okay? I would be walking through the parking lot to my room from the bar at night, and other traffickers / pimps would try and take me. And they would try and kick the door in to get to me, and I would be so frightened that when this man, my trafficker, walked in, I'd be like, oh, thank God you're here. Because he now was my savior. I would wake up in the morning and there'd be footprints on the outside of my door of people trying to get to me. This is 8 years, okay? So I am abbreviating a lot of it. Like, by now I have an addiction. I'm drinking. I have almost no possessions. I have none of my identification left. But I have my mother's ashes, okay? And then they disappeared. So it was at this point I lost it. And I phoned the domestic violence shelter, and they could hear him screaming at me in the background. And they said to me, get in a cab and get here. They'd pay for it, which I did. But when I got there, they told me they had no room for me. I had to go back. He is pissed. He is really pissed. And he decides now that I don't have the right to have a roof over my head. So now I'm living and working out of a car. Some nights were good nights where he would park the car in a park that had a porta poo. That was a good night. I remember once, I always tell this story. I was under a tree that had a huge caterpillar's nest, and a caterpillar dropped out of the tree down the crack of my ass. And I saw this thing. I didn't know what it was, and I squished it. I had nothing to clean it with. I had nothing to even clean that with. So, I mean, that was months. But you know what? I thought I was in love, and I had been raised in this, so very Catholic, okay? And I still had my faith, and you don't divorce, and you keep the family problems within the family. And I thought God was testing me. I thought that I was supposed to be learning something. I thought that, yes, the situation wasn't good, but I loved him and he loved me. The word trafficking was not in my vocabulary, and it isn't for the overwhelming majority of victims. So I tell people, never walk up to somebody and say, are you being trafficked? Because several things are going to happen. First of all, they're going to go, F you, that's my boyfriend. He would never do that to me. Second of all, you're going to lose that person if you were hoping to help them. And third of all, they're not coming back for help. If you think you see something, you can say to somebody, hey, when last did you eat? Can you just come and go when you want? Do you have any money on you? Is it your money? Things like that, because you need to let them, help them have the epiphany themselves. Because you can't make somebody do something. It's only when somebody realizes something for themselves that they wake up. So I always talk about being very careful when you address people. If I'm doing outreach on the streets, I do the 3-minute rule. if I walk up to a woman, I'll go, hey, how's business? I'll give myself 3 minutes with her because she's being watched. And I do not want to endanger her or myself. Then I carry on. And I'll come back another night and another night. It's consistency and non-judgment that help get you to be able to help somebody or enable somebody to feel like they can trust you enough to reach out. Because they know you don't want anything from them, which is huge because their whole world is people wanting from them. They don't matter. We didn't matter.
Carolyn, can I jump in?
Yes, please, sir.
Okay. Approximately how old were you when this started?
I was 35.
Okay.
I could pass for 12.
Okay. Yeah, and I see that a lot. There are many women who can pass. You see it in the movies. A lot of actresses who play high school people, they're 25 years old, so whatever. You talked about the trauma you went through. You were raped at 14, raped at 16. You talked about one day you walked into a strip bar and asked to work there, and they said, well, you can't. You have to pay. What prompted you to walk into that store, to that club?
I was told that's what I was going to be doing.
By whom?
Him. That was how I was going to make the money.
I have one question about your story, too, and mm-hmm. I may have missed it. So yeah. Did you marry your trafficker?
No, was still okay. Married. I just had disappeared.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I thought you had said something about being married to him. So no. I must have gotten that confused. Okay.
I was talking about his ex-wife. I don't know if that's where we got. Yeah.
Okay. No. That maybe have been where I got confused.
And you know what? Thank God I was still married because I would have married him because he did ask me to. So really, yay. Yay.
Yeah.
And so that. It's a good thing that you brought that up because what happens is as I work with those who have been, are being, or at high risk of being trafficked. And what we see a lot of is these traffickers getting the women pregnant or marrying them so that they are legally tied to these guys. So it's a tactic.
What was it that you were addicted to drugs at that point? You said you had 20 years sober. So when did you get clean?
I got clean. So, okay. I'm South African born.
Okay.
In South Africa before I came to Canada. And at that time I had been doing needles. And so I had overdosed. And when I came to from an overdose, I lay there and I thought I'm going to die or I'm going to go to jail. And I didn't want either of them. And I stopped right then and there. Now I'm going back, you know, it's a long time now. There was no such thing as rehab. There were no detoxes. I literally shook for a year. I couldn't hold a cup of coffee. But I knew I did not want to die. And I knew I did not want to go to jail. And that was it. Boom.
Okay, I think the part that I'm missing, and I apologize, because when you said when you walked into the club, he made you, who was he? And
Africa, my boyfriend.
And you were living with him, or?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. So we had been evicted, okay? The sheriff had come to the door and told us to get out. It was at this point I was told it was now my turn to take care of the family. And that is how I was going to take care of the family. And so we see a lot of these traffickers using the word family. And they don't call themselves pimps. They call themselves managers.
Yeah.
Which is so innocuous. But, I mean, they're clever. They're clever. I will give them that. They're clever.
So it's fair to say that when you walked into this club, I'm 64 years old. So I've been around the block. And I'm also in recovery. I'm an alcoholic in recovery. So I've been to these clubs. And I've seen the underbelly of life and yada, yada, yada. I know many strippers. There are different types of strippers. We had an Amish stripper on here once who actually went and did it for fun, I think, right? She just wanted to get free from the Amish. And so some of these strippers, they legitimately go into a strip club to make money because some of them can do very, very, very well.
Yes.
That was what gave you incentive to walk in there? You thought that I can go in there and...
I was told that I was to go in there. Now, I'm glad that you brought up what you did because I saw many young girls come in ostensibly under their own steam. Okay, within a month, they were all being managed. Okay, and
sure. Yeah.
So yes, many choose to go in under their own steam, but it never ends well. And I have personally, I'm not saying there aren't any, I have personally never seen anybody leave with anything to show for it. And when I say show for it, I don't mean a car. I don't mean furniture. I mean savings. I mean a retirement because it's a very short shelf life. Okay.
Yeah.
And what are you going to do when you go for the job interview? Oh, I was a ripper for 10 years. So I'm writing a book right now for those who exit afterwards, and it covers things like, I go for a job interview and the guy interviewing me was a customer. How do I handle that? Because of so much bias. And he's going to look at me and he's going to go, oh yeah, I'm hiring her. Or he's going to go, I'm not hiring her. It covers, so people think if you leave the sex industry or we pull someone out of being trafficked, everything's great. No. No, that's when the really hard work starts.
So I have a difficult question to ask. Yep. So you were dancing and you went into the private rooms.
Yep.
I haven't heard, and maybe you just didn't get to it, or maybe it didn't happen. I don't know.
Yeah.
Were you escorting as well, or prostituting?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Of course. And the rub and tugs, the parlors.
Right.
Excuse me. I don't like to call them parlors because that's not what they are. They're rub and tugs. I like to call it like it is, okay?
Yeah.
Call it like it is. And the parlors here, I don't know about where you guys are. The girls, the women, they walk in and they're 5 minutes late. It's a $100 fine. They are, their room isn't 100% tidy. It's another $100 fine. So they walk in ostensibly under their own steam. By the end of the month, they owe so much money that they're now being trafficked. And all of the parlors here are run by organized crime. All of them. And these are people you don't want to mess with. You know, you really don't. So they're traps, okay? I got so much I can tell you, so much I can talk about.
I'm also trying to get the timeline between when you got sober. When you put the needle down, you said it took a year for you to go through detox. Were you at the club at that point? Or this
no,
was before?
That was South Africa. That was 20 years before I even came to Canada.
Okay.
Yeah. So by the time I arrived in Canada, I had been clean for 20 years. Well, no, probably 10 years. I beg your pardon.
Okay.
And I met him probably 10 years after arriving in Canada. Yeah.
So, and you were working at all these establishments from 30 to what, 40-ish?
Till I was 8 years, so 35 plus 8.
43, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like, at some point, I mean, we still got plenty of time, but I'm dying to hear how you got out, but continue.
Okay.
We have plenty of time.
Well, I can tell you, it took me 2 years to get away. Now, I had gone to that first shelter. He then decided, oh, I've been a bad girl. I can't have a shelter. After several months of that, he said, okay, I can go back into the motels. I then called the shelter again and went there, and they had a room for me. They had a bed. But because I had been there earlier and he knew where I had been because I had to tell him in order to be able to come back, he knew where the shelter was, because usually these places are very hush-hush, right? Within 2 hours of me arriving there, they called me into the security room, and it's banks of TVs and microphones, and he's outside throwing what's left of my possessions at the building, screaming. And they managed, through microphones, to tell him to leave the premises or they were going to call the police, which he did. They then turned to me and said, you can no longer stay here as your presence here endangers all the other women. They then moved me to another shelter. Two nights into that shelter, into that stay, I was admitted to hospital with what was about to be diagnosed with colitis. Now, if you're away from the shelter for more than two nights, you're evicted. So now I'm standing on the hospital steps with the clothes on my back, an addiction, I'm a drunk, and I have one quarter, and only one person in the world I know will come and get me. Boom, I'm back. But remember, I still thought he loved me, and I still thought I loved him. Okay, so now the whole cycle starts again.
I always bring this up in almost every episode, although not so much more with the cults.
Mm-hmm.
What's the legal side of this? Because you had mentioned there was a row of hotel CD hotels.
Yeah.
I can imagine there's a row of CD. You know, I live in New York, and these strip clubs are called gentlemen clubs.
Yeah.
Some of them are high class VIP. Some of them are gin mills and are disgusting. I used to have one down the block from where I lived that was so, I wouldn't even use the bathroom when I went in there, which was, by the way, 25 years ago. Where were the police? The police did not know that this section of town.
That's a very good question. Now, human trafficking laws only came into effect in 2005. It just started for me before 2005. People didn't even know about trafficking. The one bar I was at, which is just outside of a place called Woodstock, in an area called Princeton. The Ontario Provincial Police would come in at Christmas time in full uniform and sit at the bar and watch the hockey playoffs. And we were being trafficked inches behind them. Okay. This bar, it was a brothel, okay, but they didn't care because they wanted to watch the hockey. And now we're standing there watching this and thinking, because half of them were customers anyways. Not in uniform, but when they were off duty, they were coming in, right?
Yeah, I do know that a lot of law enforcement go, this is how they blow off the steam. Yeah. What law enforcement sees during the day is traumatic, and maybe I'm watching too much TV, but I know that this is how they escape. Do you think that there was, even before 2005 or after, whether you call it human trafficking or not, escorting and these kind of seedy places.
I'm gonna answer your question. I think I know exactly what you're saying. It does not suit those with the authority and the position power to change these situations. It does not suit their agenda to change, upset the status quo, because it will then affect them in a negative manner, because they cannot go and purchase. Boom. Okay, I'm heavy into the movement and fighting and creating policy, and it's an uphill battle because so many of these politicians and law enforcement people are purchasers.
And not only purchasers, part of my other question was going to be, are they corrupt? Are they being paid off? Yeah, well, that's what I thought.
I personally never saw it, but I can't, of course, it has to be at some point. I never saw it, okay? I cannot say I saw it. But please,
If I'm a law enforcement, and I live in America, so I'm not familiar with Canadian law, Canadian culture, or law enforcement. But if I was an upstanding law enforcement officer, and I walked into a legal gentleman's club, I think I would know the difference between a woman on the stage who's doing this because she's got three kids at home, or she's got to make bills pay, I'm sure there's human trafficking, a lot of it going on in New York. Yeah. But if I walked in and I sat down as a customer, and I think they know what's going on there. They're not blind. They're educated law enforcement officers.
Of course they do. But I gotta say, just by virtue of being a customer in that establishment, you are creating a demand. If you create a demand, then there's a need for supply. Boom.
Yeah. So supply and demand, sure.
Okay. And I would like to just go backtrack a little when you said that these are the places where the law enforcement who have heavy jobs, and I know that, go to blow off steam, but you don't go and blow off steam by perpetrating trauma on other people.
Oh, no, I know. But
I say that out loud. Sorry. That's
why I distinguish between gentlemen clubs, and I know I might be being naive here, but right in New York City has five boroughs, and I know. Not now, because I'm sober and older and mature, and I don't go to these places. But back in the day, there were some high-end gentlemen clubs that when you walked in, they were clean, they were pristine. Even the VIP rooms were lavish. I remember when I turned 30, I was working out of state at a company that I was traveling for, and they all took me to a gentleman's club. And I was, of course, I was drunk and probably high at the time. No, I think I was sober then. I got sober twice in my life. And they put me up on stage and they had I had a private dance and whatever, yada, yada, yada. I'm not trained. I would not have known that any of the women that were entertaining me were there under, what's the word? Under duress.
Yeah. So I'm glad you brought that up, because we will never let you know, because if we do, we're not going to make the money. And how do I not know that you were sent by my trafficker to check and make sure that I'm actually behaving?
So, oh, very good point. Yeah, very good point.
Anything I think you need. I was dancing for a guy one night. He was about 30 and he started to cry. And I went, oh, okay, I'll bite in my mind. He goes, I'm 30 and my life just didn't turn out the way I wanted it. At which point I actually got angry and I smacked him on the shoulder and I said, hey, do you think that when I was 6, I thought I'm going to grow up and be a stripper? And he turned to me and he said, you knew about stripping when you were 6? At which point I felt sorry for him, okay? But we can't let them know. We can't. It could get us killed.
I also think there's a problem with the social services. Melody, correct me if I'm wrong. Did we not have a trafficking victim on a while back that at 16 she was trafficked and she kept getting arrested. I don't know whether it was a brothel or a gentleman's club or strip bar that they raided. She got arrested, and when she was in jail, she said this: "I'm 16 years old and I'm a minor and yeah. I'm being trafficked." But yep. nobody in the police station yep. walked up to me and said, "Are you okay? Are you?" I don't remember, Melody. Was it my other podcast or this podcast? But
no, it was this podcast. It was Elizabeth Kiros, and it was episode 27.
And it just blew me away that a 16-year-old, they locked her up because she was part of the problem, when in fact she was being trafficked as a minor, and nobody except there one sheriff, I think, that helped her.
Yeah, in the end, I think it was, yes, it just as she went into jail, but she was being arrested at that time because she was also exactly. involved in the drug trade.
So
and,
there's corruption. Yeah. There's not so much corruption, but the social services division, when they bring in criminals, the point is not every criminal that's brought in, especially if it's a minor, you pull that minor aside into a private room where they can't be found,
yeah,
and you question them, and
so I'm glad you. I love the things that you're saying. So I helped co-facilitate the Sex Buyers Accountability Program for over 15 years, which is a court-mandated diversion program for people who are arrested communicating for the purpose first offense. It's a gift, okay? They come and they spend the day with us. Now, what I do is I have to humanize us to them. I say, would you drop your mother, daughter, aunt, or niece off in a dark alley and drive away with nary another thought to her at 3 a.m? And to a man, they would all go, no. And I go, well, why'd you do it to her? And they go, well, I'm helping put food on the table for her. I said, oh, so you care about her? Yeah. I said, well, why'd you make her suck your cock? Why didn't you just give her the diapers? They don't see us as human. If you call sex, yeah. in any form or fashion, you are lower than low and you need to be spit on. Right. I have to humanize the people. We are people with hopes, dreams, wishes. These guys will say, I'll hire a hooker because my wife's mouth kisses my children. Not caring that her mouth kisses her children.
No.
You know, no. So, but we have been changing the culture and around this and the mindset. And helping them recognize that these are actually victims, because a minor cannot consent. It's automatically human trafficking.
Well, that was my point. Yeah, she was 16, and I don't know why one cop, social worker, or somebody could look at her and said, and she told our story, and Melody, we can look it up on, see what episode it was. She said that nobody would help her. It was like 4, 5, 6 times that she was arrested, and then finally somebody approached her. Tell us today in Canada,
mm-hmm.
what have you begun to change? What okay. have you?
Great question. We have something called the equality model, which is a version of the Nordic model from the Netherlands. It's Bill C-36 or CEPA, Protected Exploited Persons Act. And what it does is it criminalizes the purchasing of sex, but does not criminalize the seller. And the premise behind that is so that she, and I say she because this is overwhelmingly females, although I do work with some men and boys, okay? They are able to exit when and if they are ready without a criminal record, because you can't even be a volunteer if you have a criminal record. They have no option but to go back. So we're nailing the cause of it, the demand, okay? And allowing those people who are selling to be able to move on and lead productive, constructive, happy lives without this stigma holding them back and them not being allowed to cross the border. So this is huge. It's huge. And it also enables the government to allow money to go into programs for exit and aftercare. When it comes to trafficking, if you put a trafficked person into a domestic violence shelter, often the other women in there who are survivors of domestic abuse, their abusers had issues around pornography and prostitution. So they will then re-victimize that girl because she's seen as the enemy through lack of education, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
So what we've done is we've created safe houses, which are specific and unique and only for sex trafficking victims. But what's happened is the traffickers got wind of this and are sending in girls to pull them back out. So what we've had to do is for the first 30 days, A new person cannot interact with the other people there unless a staff member is there to prevent this. Often the cell phones and the internet is taken away from them, which is harsh because they're being like prison, okay? So it makes it hard for these women to stay because now they're being controlled again from that perspective, but it's a safety issue. So
well, I'm glad to hear that there is progressively either laws or safe, like you said, the safe houses now can only bring in the victims and not be mixed in. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I have a statement and kind of a question because I don't know a whole lot about this world, but I'm going to make a statement that really it's kind of a blanket statement, but it sounds to me like what you're saying is that anybody that is in the business of purchasing sex of any form or any type is actually contributing to this problem because I don't think that anybody can walk into a bar and tell which women are being trafficked and which women aren't. I don't think you can tell that. Can you?
No, you can't. No, you can't tell. But the thing is, it only happens because there are purchasers. And the thing is, sex is not a human right, okay? Food, water, air, safety, freedom, and education are human rights. I would go as far as to say sex is not even a need other than procreation. It's a want. And this is another thing I say to the men. They say, well, I need variety. Well, then use the other hand, buddy. Okay, don't exploit another person. I talk straight to these guys.
Yeah, and this is why I've never really opened up about this. Again, we've only had one or two traffickers on, but if the story that I just told you that I had been to many gentlemen's clubs, I have never, ever, except one time, walked into a gentleman's club, and I keep using that term. It could be just a strip club. On my own, my buddies would get together, my bachelor party, a bunch of people. Hey, we're going over to, Jane's cabaret, whatever. And I would go and I would literally be uncomfortable because especially the first time I got sober, I know that many of the women that are up on that stage are doing it for their addiction. They need the money to keep. So they're dancing, they're going in the bathroom to do crack or do heroin. And so the money that comes in goes right back out again. Yep. And the dealer is probably the pimp or the manager. And so I slowly stopped going. And I can't tell you the last time I went to one, and I will never go to one again. It just made me uncomfortable knowing that the women up there, I don't know. And I had, believe it or not, on my other podcast, which is a modern dating podcast, and I had a stripper, a couple strippers come on, and one of them wrote a book about how it saved her life, how she made money and how she's still doing it. And she's from Canada, but she had control of her own business. She runs a business. I'm not going to get into that, but it's a disgusting trade, I think, to
so it's I beg your pardon. People would say, well, she's choosing to do it. What I would say to the men is the mortgage is due. The kids haven't eaten since yesterday. You look around and in the parking lot, the driveway is your Porsche. Are you choosing to sell it or you do have no other choice but to sell it? Okay. So this notion of choice, Dr. Melissa Farley has done the research. 95% of those in the sex trade went out. Who do we legislate for, the 95% or the 5%, okay? The notion of choice is a privilege and a luxury that is afforded to very, very few people, okay? You can go and beg on the streets or pan and you make like 20 bucks, right? That's not enough to feed the kids and pay the rent. And any woman that is panning on the streets is going to have at least four guys say, hey, I'll give you 60 bucks for a BJ. Eventually, she's going to do it because she's got to feed her kids. She's not choosing to. She's got no other choice. So, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Every city is filled with this. Every city, even the nice cities.
So where I live, the community did a survey. And the only place these children feel safe at night is in their bedrooms because of the men trolling around the homes. How dare his penis frighten that child that he's never met? How dare his penis take precedence over that child's right to feel safe where they live? They're not taking this shit to their areas. They're bringing it to ours. and all the accompanying crime that comes with it. The property values go down. Now, I've been to Germany and Amsterdam, and both of those places, Germany, of the 400,000 known people in the sex industry, 88% of them are trafficking victims. Organized crime comes in and takes over to the degree that both Germany and Amsterdam are looking at rescinding the law. There's a big problem, though, because they've had it in place for so long that all of the outlying industries like the taxi drivers, the hotels, the restaurants will crumble if they take away the sex industry, because so much is built on these.
Yeah, well, Amsterdam, you got the red light district, which is half their tourism. So yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And when you legalize, your country becomes a sex tourist destination. And personally, I don't think that's anything to brag about, but that's just my opinion. Okay. But in my opinion, the way I look at it, this then makes the state become their trafficker, their pimp, because they're making all this money off of them. That's just the way I see it. And people can argue that and debate that with me, but that's how I see it.
Okay. So let's bring it to 2025. I guess I have a two-part question. What's going on now in the world of trafficking in Canada? I don't know if you can speak to the United States. And what can, actually, I guess it's a three-part question. What if I hope a human victim, trafficking victim, might be listening and they want to get out? How can they get out safely? And three, how can the population, can anything that we can do?
Yeah. So when I do my public speech, the very last thing I always say to the audience is, if the only thing you do is tell one person about it, you've done something. But what they really can do, if they don't want to get involved in the front line, because I got to tell you, it's really hardcore stuff, man.
Oh, I know it is. Yeah.
It will change you. Okay. The stuff I see, and I've got working with a woman who's kept in a dog cage, who was cut from her anus to her vagina and made to eat what came out, okay, by the people. So I'm not saying that the front line is for everybody, but you can go and petition your local politicians. You can go and put an end to these rub and tugs, because almost all of them are.
Yeah.
Okay, you don't have to go to the dirty level like the front line. There's stuff you can do. You can go and educate your children. We're talking about the sexualization of our youth. This pimp culture, you know, like Pimp My Ride, they're making it normalized. No, pimping is not okay. And it's not to be laughed and joked about and made normal.
I happen to know. So when I don't live in New York City. I live outside about 20 miles in one of the suburbs. And I hear maybe twice a month, and that's only what I hear, that law enforcement raids these rub and tugs.
Yeah.
Because they're, and I'm not picking out any ethnicity, but yeah, a lot of them are Asian massage parlors.
Yep.
And you go in there for a massage, but you got a secret code, and they take you in the back and you get the massage. And then, of course, the rub and tug.
Yeah.
And they're being brought down. They're being, I think the public knows which ones are which,
yeah,
and they're being reported. And at least the law enforcement in my area are raiding them and bringing them down.
See, you brought up another really good thing. If you look at that and you see how many of them are Asian women, it's because the sex industry is racist. You see these Asian women as forbidden fruit or whatever. They want the Asian woman, so the Asian women are being trafficked into those areas.
Well, it's also part of the culture. The geishas, they're called geishas, right? The Asian submissives.
Yeah, it's not part of their culture to be giving massages to fat white men.
No, but the American male population, yeah, has been, yeah, taught that these, yeah, geishas are there for their pleasure.
It's a stereotype, okay? It's a racist stereotype.
Yeah, yeah.
They're just women. These are women. That's all they are.
And there's Latina ones, there's American ones. They're all over. So, I mean, I just brought the Asian ones up because I know they're the dominant.
Here, the rub and tugs, it's big on the Asians. Now, in Canada, the indigenous population represents 4% of the total pop, but they represent over 50% of all human trafficking victims. So it is racist because they see them as dirty Indians or whatever, and blah, 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 blah. So, and the colonization, I mean, it's that's the history there, right?
It's the same here in America. The Native Americans here are being trafficked. Yep.
Yeah. Colonization and its That's a whole nother show, though. Okay, it's a whole nother show.
Yeah. Absolutely disgusting and horrible. And I thank you for sharing your story. Any parting thoughts?
Yes. I'd like to say that there is hope at the end of the tunnel. I went to college. I got three. I did Human Services Foundation, Social Service Worker, General Arts and Science. I received the Queen's Diamond Jubilee Medal, the Hope Award.
Oh, good for you.
And awards for my work in this area. And there is hope. Like, I walk with some of these women for over a decade. Like the one woman, she used to walk into parks at 4 or 5 in the morning, hoping someone would murder her. I've walked this journey with her. She's graduated college. She has a child. She's self-sufficient. There is hope. And I also would like to point out that it's not just a child who gets trafficked. If they come from a loving family, the family's being trafficked too, because I'm dealing with parents that are sobbing. Help me, help me, help me. I need my child back. Help me.
Tell us about you said you're writing a book?
Yes, it's for survivors, those who have exited for afterwards. And it's covering things like, why do I still love my trafficker? Now, if he's the father of your children, that gets complicated, okay?
Well, and it's also Munchausen syndrome. Stockholm. I always get those two confused. Yeah.
Bonding and all of that. But they don't know. So they're very isolated. They're sitting in an apartment all by themselves. They got no friends because they've taken out of that culture and put into a culture where they don't speak the language and having to try and fit in. And so it helps them ride it out, hopefully. That's why I take the calls at 3 and 4 in the morning, because I know what it's like to sit there. I'm jonesing for my drugs. I have no friends because this is a whole new world for me. I'm alone. I'm lonely. And I want my drugs. And I know if I pick up the phone, they'll come get me. No, pick up the phone and call me and we'll ride it out. We'll ride it out.
And so where can people find you today online so they can help donate or get more information?
Well, I can give you my email, but I have the human trafficking page, which...
The Facebook
Melody
page.
Spoke about earlier.
And we will put a link to that in our show notes.
Because I've traveled extensively, I've been able to pull people out in South Africa, Cambodia, Puerto Rico, all across the States and Alaska through that page. So it's been an amazing experience. We're over 10,000 members now, which is not a lot in comparison to a lot of other pages.
But it's a good number.
Yeah, we're getting there. So there is light at the end of the tunnel. There is hope. We just got to want better. When I talk to young kids in schools, I talk about what healthy relationships are supposed to look like. I talk about if somebody asks you to do something that they wouldn't do, run.
Yeah.
Okay? Healthy relationships. And I talk about what consent means and what it looks like. Because you don't want to go in and scare the young kids, right? But I want to give them foundation, a solid foundation with which to walk up off of.
Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story, Caroline, and being brave, and for the advocacy work that you do for others. It's inspiring. And I'm just going to say that I myself am a cult survivor, but I can also add that, you know, and I hadn't actually looked at it this way, but I do know that my cult actually is or was involved after I left in human trafficking in the form of polygamy and having young underage girls marrying the leaders and all of that. That is another form of human trafficking. So it has other forms too.
And it's kind of why we included human trafficking with cults, because there is a crossover and there is a similar
Yes, you've got the coercive control, you've got the brainwashing that's involved, and you know, all of that stuff there's a lot of links, a lot of parallels.
When I talk to parents, I tell them you're going to war, and I equate it with dealing with a cult mindset when you're trying to get somebody back out. Because it is. It absolutely is.
Okay, Caroline, thank you again. When your book is out, let Melody or I know, and maybe we'll have you back on, or we'll promote the book in some way. And
thank you
for the work you do.
Okay,
yes,
thank you.
Thank you so much. We want to once again thank Caroline so much for coming on the show and sharing her story with us and bringing awareness and being an advocate for fellow human trafficking survivors and doing all the work that she does. It's so impressive, so amazing. I can't say enough good things about her and what she's doing for that world and people in that world.
Yeah, and I'm glad she stepped forward, because when we started the podcast, I knew about human trafficking, and I just wanted to include it with the cults because, but as you know, what are we at? 45 episodes, 46. Well, you only have a handful of, if that much, of human trafficking. So we would, so if you are listening.
Yeah.
Okay. So if to the audience, if you are listening and you are able to come forward and talk about your story, we would absolutely love to hear your story and get it out there. As Caroline said, I think the general population just doesn't really know or care as much. And it's a despicable business. Like I said, in the interview, I don't go to those kind of clubs. And I watched a documentary not too long ago, actually several, of what goes on behind the porn industry. And I don't watch porn anymore. And I haven't in God, I can't remember how long. So all of that stuff, it's just off my radar today. But I do want to report on it, and because it is very much active and very much alive today, and people are suffering.
And I will share a little personal story. The closest I ever came to getting involved in that industry, which, I mean, I was actually working at a Goodwill as a cashier. I had just gotten out of the cult. I was a single mom at the time, but I was dating a guy who a guy who bought a house next to the Goodwill where I was working. And he was a really nice guy. He started bringing flowers to us girls who worked in the Goodwill. Like every Friday he would show up and he'd bring us all flowers. And he was kept saying, "I'm opening a hobby shop next door. And when I open up my hobby shop, I want you to come work for me." And I was really like thinking, I was kind of flattered. I was like, "Oh, what kind of hobby shop?" I'm thinking, you know, toy trains, or I didn't know. I mean, I was pretty innocent and young at the time. I was maybe 20. And then my boyfriend happened to need a job at that time, and he was in the construction industry, and he started doing some construction at this house that he was working. And after he had been working there for a couple of weeks, he's like, "I don't think that's a hobby shop that they're doing there, Mel. I think it's something else." And I'm like, "Well, what is it? What do you mean?" And he's like, "Well, there's a big pole and a stage." I was still so naive. I was like, "I don't know what you're talking about." I was still like, kind of like, "I don't know. What I mean, what is that for?" I'm thinking, "Is that for the trains? Are they going to set up like the trains on this stage?" Because I was so naive. And he's like, No. He's like, "It's like a stripper stage. That's what it looks like to me. There's poles in the stage." And I'm like, "Oh." And then it turned out that he wanted me to come. This is where he wanted me to start. I'm sure he probably eventually wanted me on the stage, but what he wanted me to do was literally the job he wanted me to come do, because he did come ask me to come work for him, was to essentially, I'm going to call it what they called it, come clean the cum closets, like the screens and stuff in these. I'm like, "Oh my God, no." So I think that was his way of trying to pull me into this industry where eventually I probably would have been on the stage, and who knows where that could have led. But it was crazy because the way he was bringing us flowers and stuff, he was kind of grooming us.
Love bombing.
Yeah. And at the time I was so naive. I had no clue. I just knew that I had no interest in going to work for him at that point. But that was as close as I ever came to getting involved in that industry. So luckily,
it's fair to say that if it wasn't for your boyfriend, you might have.
I might have been naive enough and not known what I was getting involved in. But he figured out what was going on there and was telling me, "This is not an innocent little hobby shop like you're thinking." And actually, the county where it was ended up closing it down anyway because it was in a school zone and all this stuff. He wasn't zoned. Good. He didn't do it legally. Good. It got closed down pretty quickly. So, but once again, crazy story. Once again, we want to thank Caroline for coming on the show and sharing her story with all of us. And we want to thank all of you as well for tuning into Cultimatum. As always, your support is appreciated. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate and review us on platforms such as Apple and Spotify. And don't forget to follow, share, and keep listening to all of our latest episodes.
You can also connect with us by joining our Facebook group, Cultimatum Podcast, where we dive deeper into these important topics.
And you can also find us on additional social media platforms such as Instagram, Pinterest, TikTok, YouTube, and Threads.
If you have a personal experience with cults or a human trafficking story that you'd like to share, reach out to us at cultimatumpodcast@gmail.com.
And if you are an ex-cult member in need of any additional support, you can consider joining the Cult Escape and Recovery Group on Facebook.
You can also check out my other podcast, the Anonymous Andrew Modern Dating Podcast. And please, I rebranded the podcast, so it is strictly about dating. So if you're single or just looking for a fresh perspective on the dating scene, come check me out. If you'd like to help us with the cost of maintaining the podcast, this one and mine, or both, or either, you can show your support through, in the show notes, there is a link called Buy Us a Cup of Coffee. And that will take you to a page where you can donate $5 or $10 to the show. There is no subscription. You're not signing up. We don't take your email. It's simply a donation to the show. And every little bit helps in our mission to spread awareness about cults and human trafficking.
And as always, stay safe, stay informed, and remember, you are not alone.